You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hello, my name is Dr. Katya Harfman. I'm a pediatric dermatologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. And joining me today for this vodcast is Professor Zoe Apala.
Hello, my name is Zoe Apala, and I am a professor of dermatology at the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki in Greece. In this vodcast, we will be discussing how we assess disease severity in alopecia areata, or AA, including how to dig deeper into conversations with patients when assessing their severity. This vodcast is published in the American Journal of Clinical Dermatology. Let's start with a general overview of AA. Katya, what is the definition of AA and its different clinical presentations?
Sure, Zoe. AA is an autoimmune disease that is characterized by non-scarring hair loss of the scalp, face, and/or body. It affects individuals of any age and often begins in adolescence. The clinical presentation of AA can vary from patchy AA, which is the partial loss of scalp hair, to alopecia totalis, which is complete loss of scalp and face hair, and alopecia universalis, which is complete loss of scalp, face, and body hair. Despite the varying extent of hair loss, these are all forms of AA. In recent years, three therapies for the treatment of severe AA have been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and in some other countries. Ritlecitinib, a JAK3 and TEC kinase family inhibitor, is approved for both adults and adolescents aged 12 years and older. Baricitinib and deuruxolitinib are both JAK1 and 2 inhibitors and are approved for adults only. Zoe, now that we have these three treatments approved, how do we actually define severe AA, and how can we measure disease severity?
This is a great question. There is no one definition for severity, and the heterogeneity of AA has led to several different approaches to defining disease severity. So, this is often left to the judgment of clinicians. Today, we will discuss some helpful tools that can be used to define what severity means in AA. Severity assessments can be important for both deciding on treatment approach and evaluating treatment response. The European AA Consensus Statement on the Systemic Treatment of AA, published in 2024 by expert dermatologists, includes a variety of methods to assess severity. Severity assessments for use in clinical practice need to be both accurate and simple to use in everyday practice.
Zoe, can you tell us more about the severity of alopecia tool?
Yes, great question. The severity of alopecia tool, or SALT, is the most common scale that is used to measure AA-related hair loss in clinical trials, and it is sometimes used also in clinical practice. It is a calculation to determine the percentage area of any terminal hair loss by dividing the scalp into quadrants. Multiplying the percentage scalp hair loss in a given quadrant by the total scalp area of that quadrant and adding together the numbers for each quadrant to determine the total percentage. SALT scores range from 0 to 100. With a score of 100 indicating complete scalp hair loss and a score of 0 indicating none. The advantage of SALT is that it is a standardized method, but one of the disadvantages is that it does not consider other important clinical presentation factors involved in AA beyond scalp hair loss and can sometimes take time to complete if you are not familiar with the tool. Katya, what other measures of AA severity can we use that capture more than just scalp hair loss?
Another measure of severity we can use is the AA scale, which was specifically developed for use in clinical practice and includes additional criteria for assessing disease severity beyond scalp hair loss. The primary basis of the AA scale is an estimate of the extent of scalp hair loss. Patients with less than 20% scalp hair loss are considered to have mild AA. Those with 21% to 49% are classified as having moderate AA. And patients with 50% to 100% are classified as having severe AA. The AA scale also includes secondary clinical features, which increase the AA severity rating by one level if one or more of them are present. These include involvement of eyebrows and eyelashes, and inadequate response after at least 6 months of treatment, which was selected to represent treatment response, since an inadequate response is generally only considered to have occurred after 3 to 6 months of therapy. The other features included in the AA scale are negative impact on psychosocial functioning, including emotional or psychological impacts and clinical depression and anxiety, and a positive hair pull test.
Can you please explain for the listeners what the hair pull test is?
Sure. The hair pull test is a simple, quick method to monitor hair loss. A clinician gently pulls a tuft of 50 to 60 hairs from the scalp, and if more than 10% of the hairs come out easily, it is considered a positive result. This suggests active hair loss and can serve as an indicator of how quickly a patient's hair loss is progressing.
Let's go through an example of a patient assessment. For example, if you have a patient with 30% scalp hair loss, they would be considered to be a moderate AA patient based on the primary criterion of extent of hair loss. But if they have one or more of those secondary criteria, say this patient has eyebrow involvement or a negative emotional burden, then that patient would be categorized as having severe AA.
So how do these assessments help you make decisions in clinical practice?
These assessments remind me that percentage of scalp hair loss may not always be the primary factor influencing their quality of life. And AA affects individuals differently and in a more complicated way. Therefore, it is important to look at the patient in a holistic way. In terms of treatment decisions, the European AA consensus statement states that a general medical indication for systemic therapy is a SALT score of 20 or more, corresponding to moderate to severe AA. Based on this statement and the AA scale, it is possible that a patient with 20% or more scalp hair loss can be a candidate for systemic therapy, such as the recently approved kinase inhibitors.
I agree, Zoe. These assessments are helpful in determining the appropriate treatment approach for each patient. Another consensus recently published in 2024 called the AA Severity and Morbidity Index, or ASAMI, also highlighted that severity assessments should include factors beyond just scalp hair loss. This suggests that AA experts are more frequently considering a multifactorial severity assessment in their practice. Zoe, what other factors do you consider important to assess?
In my practice, I have found that eyebrow and eyelash loss is very important to patients and their perception by others. Patients who have lower severity in terms of scalp hair loss may still seek treatment because of eyebrow and eyelash loss. Beard hair can also be equally as important, if not more important, to some patients than eyebrows and eyelashes. Additionally, the hair loss phenotype and the patient's desired hairstyle can determine the negative impacts.
I agree. For instance, the ophiasis phenotype, which involves exclusive occipital area hair loss, may not be as impactful in females as eyebrow and eyelash involvement, since long hair can cover the hair loss, whereas the face cannot be hidden. However, the same phenotype may be more impactful for females whose activities, such as work requirements, gym, and gymnastics, require their hair to be arranged in a secured style. This shows that there may be varying and unique considerations for patients with the same extent or pattern of hair loss when assessing severity, and that the visibility of the hair loss can affect the impact on the patient.
That is a great point and brings us to the impact of AA on the patient. The experience varies greatly among patients. While some may experience little to no impact on their quality of life, others may face significant challenges affecting their emotional well-being, relationships, and lifestyle. AA is a disease that involves much more than just hair loss. Some of the psychosocial effects of the disease can include changes in patients' feeling, ways of coping, and relationships with family, friends, and co-workers. Patients may worry that others will notice their hair loss, which makes them less confident in their appearance, with some patients spending many hours on concealing their AA using makeup and wigs. Katia, do you have any individual examples of how patients have changed their behavior due to AA in your practice?
Yes, absolutely. I've had patients and families express some deep impacts to behavior. I often see children stop participating in activities like sports and swimming that may have previously brought them a lot of joy, but now primarily bring concern about how to participate in the same way with hair loss. I've also seen children stop attending school, opting for homeschool or online schooling to avoid peer interactions that may be centered on alopecia. Other patients have experienced negative judgment from others, which has caused them to feel embarrassed about their appearance when going out in public. Additionally, some patients fear that people outside of their families will discover that they have AA and even conceal their AA in their own home out of fear of friends unexpectedly visiting. Zoe, do you have any examples from your practice?
In some cases, it is not only about daily activities. AA may also affect professional life. I can recall a patient of mine with severe alopecia barbae, who was an Orthodox priest, and he was seriously thinking of quitting his profession due to AA. The long hair and the beard represent important symbols in many religions, and for an Orthodox priest, they are very important. Given these examples and the large negative impact that AA can have on individuals, measuring the psychosocial impacts of AA is as important as measuring the physical effects. One simple way of measuring psychosocial impacts is using a Likert scale, as suggested in the AA scale, where a patient is asked to rate the impact of AA on their quality of life on a scale of 0, not at all important, to 10, extremely important. Other measures include the Dermatology Life Quality Index and Alopecia Areata Symptom Impact Scale. Katia, which instruments do you use in your practice to assess quality of life impacts of AA?
This can be very difficult since it is so subjective. I occasionally use the Children's Dermatology Life Quality Index, which is a 10-question tool designed to evaluate the impact of skin disease on the quality of life of children over the last week, using a scale from not at all to very much. It is similar to the Dermatology Life Quality Index, which is used to assess the impact of skin disease on the quality of life of adults. I also have some basic questions that I often use to assess severity and quality of life impacts based on my experience. You can specifically ask about behavioral changes that are attributed to AA, such as participation in activities, willingness to go outside, and if they are masking their hair loss or wearing wigs outside or inside the house. Parents can also be a valuable source of information, but questions should be directed to the affected patient as often as possible, which may require a one-on-one conversation. Nevertheless, it should also be considered that patients may minimize the impact of the condition to avoid feeling like a burden. Additionally, if they have access to mental health support, it can be very useful in helping to assess the emotional burden. There are also quality of life assessments that you can use, but they often do not capture the full burden of AA, as its impact can vary from one patient to another. Do you agree, Zoe?
Yes, I agree. I also do not use a specific checklist to assess severity and quality of life impacts in my practice, and patient assessments are individualized. It is important to assess daily activities as well as self-esteem and occupational well-being. Patients may avoid certain activities and social or professional settings due to fears that their AA may be noticed and feeling uncomfortable. Hair loss can impact major life decisions regarding relationships, education, or careers more than we realize, which is why asking about the burden of AA is important. Katya, do you use a different approach to assess quality of life impacts of AA in adolescents?
Yes, it is more difficult to assess severity in adolescents. There is a particularly high burden in teenage patients. Therefore, age-related considerations such as sports, bullying, interaction with peers, and staying home from school may better reflect the psychosocial impact of AA. For example, adolescents often experience significant bullying, which can lead to school avoidance, anxiety, and depression. Therefore, even at a young age, I would consider reduced self-confidence and self-esteem to be indicators of quality of life impacts. What has your experience with adolescent patients been like?
I agree. It is much more challenging to evaluate the psychosocial impact in adolescents than adults. When treating younger patients, I will ask their parents about their child's AA. When treating adolescents, I will often speak to the patient alone and focus on relationship building to get honest answers from them. Sometimes speaking to the patient alone is a good way to help them feel more comfortable and allow them to open up about their experiences. Do you use your assessment of the burden of AA in adolescents to inform your treatment decisions?
In terms of treatment management, the decisions can be complex, and I think that it is important to involve patients in the treatment decision. Thus, I do take psychosocial impacts into consideration. For example, adolescents can be less impacted than their parents, which may not justify the risk of treatment. However, there is a risk of poorer prognosis if AA is left untreated for any patient, with data showing that the shorter the duration of the disease episode, the better the response. Therefore, this and negative psychosocial impacts would also factor into my decision on whether to initiate or delay the treatment and could justify more aggressive treatment with JAK inhibitors. To wrap up this discussion, what do you think is the best approach for assessing AA to inform treatment decisions based on what we have discussed today?
I think that there is still a long way to go with AA assessments in terms of capturing the full disease burden. Clinicians can be informed by evidence-based tools, but in practice, they will likely further assess severity by asking patients about how much AA affects their participation in activities, mental health, and well-being. But overall, the approach should be based on each individual. Thank you, Katya, for sharing your expertise, and I hope that everyone who listened to this podcast will take away an improved understanding of measuring disease severity in AA.
Thank you, Zoe, for sharing your thoughts and joining me today for this fascinating conversation.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.